Sure is. And your phone calls all hour long with Philip Plait. I'll be back in a moment, though. I want to get his take on a couple issues, then we'll go to calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Philip, what do you think about SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, spending their money wisely or a project that should go away?
I think that using radio telescopes to look for intelligent signals from space is probably a good idea. If you sort of think about intelligent civilizations like us or more advanced, radio is a pretty good way to communicate across interstellar distances, and especially for a young civilization, if you're technologically new, radio astronomy is a pretty easy thing to stumble on. And radio waves travel at the speed of light, and you can make them pretty powerful without having to work too hard at it. So it's probably not a bad idea. Now, it was funded by NASA for a while, and honestly, I don't necessarily think it's the kind of thing NASA should be doing. I think it's a little bit too pie in the sky for NASA. So when SETI went to private funding, I thought that was a pretty good idea. I think it should be done, and I think that doing it privately is probably the way to do it. And I know, I believe Seth Shostak's been on the show several times, hasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. And Paul Allen, of course, Microsoft fame, is
right.
The big contributor now to SETI.
And Seth and I are old friends. As a matter of fact, he does a radio show, and I participate on that once a month called Are We Alone? And I think it's pretty good. It's certainly not very expensive in the long run. It actually does push technology quite a bit. They've had to develop some pretty interesting technology to do it. And as a byproduct, they get a lot of astronomy out of this as well because they're building radio telescopes. So at the very worst thing that can happen is they're actually scanning the skies in radio wavelengths and we're learning some science.
Okay, and how about this? Caller calls first hour. We're talking about global warming. He has this idea to put a diffuser on the sun between, where gravity doesn't affect it, to like a big sail or something. Is this possible? Can you shade the sun with some kind of huge mirror or diffuser?
You know, it's funny. I'm reading a series of books right now called Red Mars and Blue Mars and Green Mars, and maybe not in that order. I can't remember. And colonists go to Mars, and they try to make it more like Earth. And one of the things they do is they have to heat it up because it's cold. Well, on the Earth, we have the opposite problem. We have a planet that's heating up, and this process of changing a planet to make it more Earth-like is called terraforming. And in fact, we kind of have to terraform the Earth because we've been doing the opposite for hundreds of years now. And how do you cool off a whole planet? The amount of energy the sun dumps on the Earth is huge. It dwarfs our entire nuclear arsenal. Every second, there's more energy being dumped on the surface of the Earth. And so how do you do this? Well, the first thought is maybe a giant mirror in space or something that blocks the sunlight. The problem is it would have to be huge. The Earth is 8,000 miles across. And so if you wanted to block all of the sunlight, you'd have to make a disk 8,000 miles across. Well, if you want to block 10% of the sunlight, you still need to make something that has, that's still hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles across, and we just don't have the technology to do that. Even if it meant the destruction of the Earth, we just couldn't build something like that right now if we had to.
Not practical. To the phones we go, west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hello. This is Alan calling from Lost Wages.
Hello, Alan. How are you?
Okay. I was just listening, and I have or had a couple of hobbies. One of them, a long time ago, I found someone in Phoenix who was, I guess, a wholesaler. He would go to Canyon Diablo illegally, which is a national park, with a metal detector, and find these meteorites and then sell them to the retailers. And I caught him outside the door, and he sold, a bunch to me for, set price. And I went to, Rockhound. They have meetings once a month, and they had someone from, a University of Arizona that had different kinds of meteorites, and he was saying that the university is willing to pay $100 a pound for organic meteorites. This is something that is not of this world, but you literally could grow things from it, and which is totally bizarre. And, you know, that probably supports a theory to some scientists that life is out there. It's just they haven't found it. They don't know where it is. They see UFOs that come and go, and they just large things, and they don't know where they go to, where they came from. And it's just, I don't know. And a couple of weeks ago, I wanted to get on the radio, but he wouldn't let me on the radio. But
who's
I was
he?
At work.
What do you mean he? He who?
Oh, I'm sorry. The guy that screens the phone calls on a weekday.
Well, you must have called at the wrong time.
Maybe I did. But I saw something in the sky. It was kind of, I was at work, and it was dusk. It was going into dark. And this thing didn't have any flashing lights, no lights whatsoever. At first, I thought it was trash blowing in the air. But it was very large and very close to this building that they're building. And it was, it looked like, I guess, a steel beam. Instead of going straight like a plane, it was coming like at a side angle. And when it started going out of view, it started going into a V shape and back straight. And I'm like, what in the world is that? And then my coworkers came out and I explained to them, and they think, I'm just totally nuts, you know, seeing this huge thing. In the sky, it shook me, you know, it literally shook
okay.
me.
Okay, all right, but do you have a question for Philip, the astronomer?
Okay, yeah, like I said again with the meteorites that you could grow things from, how does that connect to there could be life elsewhere that we haven't discovered yet? I mean, things, you know, this thing is not of the world, but you could grow, I don't know, a plant out of it or something like that. I mean, how can that be?
Well, I know meteorite collecting is actually a lot of fun. It's something I always wanted to do, and I actually started up my collection a few years ago, and I've got some Canyon Diablo. This is iron from the impact out in the Arizona desert. There's a crater that's almost a mile across, and it's owned by a family, the Beringer family, and it's private property, and all around it is actually Native American property. So if they find you prospecting out there, yeah, you're going to get thrown in jail either under federal charges or civil charges. Either way, it's no fun. But I actually have some what are called carbonaceous chondrite meteorites, and these are stony meteorites. They're not made of iron, and these are the kind that sometimes will have amino acids in them. Now, I don't know of any that have anything like bacteria or viruses or anything like that, because if that were true, you'd be hearing it all over the news.
Except maybe the Martian meteorite.
Yeah, right, the Martian meteorite. And in fact, there's some new evidence that the Martian meteorite may have had bacteria in it at some point. It's pretty sketchy evidence, but it's starting up that argument all over again. And so I suppose that some of these carbonaceous meteorites have nitrogen in them. They have the sort of things that if you grind them up and stick a seed in it, you might be able to grow a seed into a plant, but I can't guarantee that. I'd have to think about that and see what's in them. Most of them they're just silicon and carbon. There's not much in them. As far as being able to like stick them in water and having something grow on its own, I don't think that's possible. But it's possible that what they're doing is the University of Arizona has a very good meteorite group of people who study them there. And so I imagine they're collecting them, looking for organics, looking for amino acids and such. And maybe that's what was going on.
Okay, thanks. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on with Philip Plate. Hi there.
Good morning, George and Philip. Before I get into the galaxy, you said the furthest away, AB 2218, 13 billion light years away, 2,000 light years across. That's 150th of ours, by the way. Birth 750 million years after the Big Bang. I wanted to address a concern that George had about what this Big Bang thing really all meant, and it became apparent to me what was confusing, George, and I think confusing so many else out there. It's hard for many to envisage the extent of the vacuum of space. And two, there's a perverse attempt by so many to mix up the vacuum of space with the material, the matter, and the energy within it. So when it's said that space is bent, it's assumed that somehow the vacuum of space is bent rather than the material, the energy within it. So what I'd like to suggest, George, and maybe Philip could assist in some future program, is that you envisage putting all of the stuff in the toroidal design that we have. That's a shape like a donut, something that Arthur M. Young offered up some years ago. And just lumping these things together, and then the mathematics would be apparent in terms of the percentage of that toroidal that that then would represent. And then the next step and last step is to extrapolate the vacuum of the particles that are within those molecules and atoms that make up what is bumped together then. We are so filled with vacuum. William A. Tiller has pointed that out in his remarkable research at Stanford. And I think if you have him on the show, he'll be able to depict for you what's important to note about this. I'm very excited about this finding, this AB2218, this furthest galaxy away. And I wanted to ask Philip if he can give a percentage of the number of stars that have disappeared from the sky in the direction of that galaxy that would indicate just what kind of changes have occurred, are occurring in our universe, just how old things are, because the light has simply died away. Those stars have changed a long time ago, but they've only now disappeared from our screen, so to speak.
I think, I just did a quick Google search while you mentioned it. I think you're talking about Abel 2218. There's a picture that was taken by Hubble, actually by an acquaintance of mine named Andy Fruchter, that shows a massive cluster of galaxies. This is a group of galaxies. So you can imagine, we were talking about our Milky Way having 100 billion stars. Now imagine thousands or hundreds of thousands of these galaxies all clustered together. The gravity is so strong from a cluster that a galaxy that's actually on the other side of it, its light gets bent. It sort of like acts like a lens. And there's a galaxy on the other side of this cluster that got lensed in this matter, and it's actually the most distant galaxy ever measured, according to this website I'm looking at. I've heard of this before. It's so far away, and I'm guessing it's well over 12 billion light years away, if I'm reading this number correctly, that all of the light that we're seeing from it would be coming from stars that may in fact have already died, because a star like the Sun lasts for roughly 10 or 11 billion years. And so if you were to be at a galaxy 10 billion light years away from our galaxy, a star like the Sun would have already died by then. So it's pretty interesting to think of that, especially since most of the light that comes from a galaxy comes from brighter stars than the Sun, and they live less. They actually have a shorter lifespan. So in fact, I can almost guarantee you that the light coming from this galaxy, if it's coming from stars, They're probably all long dead by now.
Isn't that strange that the stars would die out and we still get the light? And even though I know that it happens, it's just weird knowing that what's behind it is gone.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I mean, somebody was asking me about this recently, about the stars that we see in the sky. And I thought to myself, the most distant star you can see with the naked eye just going out at night is really quite close. It's only 1,000 light years away. And stars live for millions of years. So people say, are all the stars that we see, are they already gone? I say, no. The stars that we see are close enough that the light travel time to get from there to here for the light is short compared to their lifetime. So chances are the star is still there. But when you start talking about galaxies, things are different. In the Andromeda galaxy, that's almost 3 million light years away. So the light we see now took 3 million years to get here. A lot of the stars that we see in that galaxy are gone. They've already blown up and disappeared. And that light is already on its way here. It's
all
a
right.
Weird way to think of things.
Let's go to our first-time caller line, Philip. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Rod. I'm calling from Wimberley, Texas.
Sure thing, Rod. Go ahead, sir.
I have a quick question, quick comment. My question is, you talked earlier about the WMAP, that probe that is that can see things far away into the universe. Can that probe see something that you talked about also earlier about ripples in space?
No, it's I was trying to be careful in the way I chose my words. In fact, the WMAP satellite does look for ripples, but it's looking for physical ripples. The things that it's looking at are the leftover fires, if you will, from the Big Bang and the gas that was heated up. And that gas was not perfectly smoothly distributed through space. It actually has very, very subtle ripples in it. And these are actual physical changes. The ripples I was talking about before are actually things called gravity waves, which is a really bizarre ramification of Einstein's relativity. And those you can't see. You can detect them. It's hard to do, and as a matter of fact, nobody's ever detected them directly, although the technology is getting better, and there are some people that are hoping to detect them very soon. But those are actually a fluctuation of space itself, not the stuff in it. And it's as bizarre as anything you can imagine. If it doesn't make sense, believe me, it shouldn't surprise you, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But you can read about these online if you look up gravitational right. waves, and you'll find some really interesting websites about them.
You have a great blog, by the way.
Thanks.
Also, quick comment, George, can I?
Yeah, absolutely.
The solar eclipse that you were mentioning earlier, March 29th, and the earlier caller talked about earthquake in Jerusalem. That's the same day as the solar eclipse. I just wanted to point that out.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and there's a lot of software that you could buy for your computer that actually takes you to the solar eclipse in Libya, where you can actually see the solar eclipse as, you know, animated, but there's certain software out there that really does it justice.
There's a lot of what they call planetarium software. Some of it's free. You can download it. Some of it's actually quite expensive. But you can find it online typically if you look up planetarium software for your computer. And a lot of it's really stunning, and you can see sort of 3D visualizations of what's going on. During eclipses, the sun and the moon's gravity does line up, and so you might sort of think that you get more earthquakes at times like that, but from what I've read, there is no statistical correlation between earthquakes and the phase of the moon, even during solar eclipses. So I wouldn't expect to see an earthquake then. And of course, you know, there's always an earthquake somewhere. I also don't happen to put a whole lot of stock in visions from dreams. So I won't go into that too much, but I expect there will be earthquakes during the eclipse, because there are earthquakes every day. We'll just see what gets claimed because of that.
Were you a member of your astronomy club in high school? I was.
We didn't have one when I was in high school, but I did have. There were a lot of science clubs and stuff, and I did all that. I did all that geek stuff.
I love that stuff. You know what? I went out and got myself a telescope, and just loved the heavens, Philip.
It is so wonderful to spend a nice warm night under the sky and looking at things like Saturn and the moon and all of that. It's very relaxing. And
even the crispy nights in Detroit as a kid were nice.
Oh, dear.
You're out there. You're all by yourself. It's crackly out. It's really nice. I'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls with our special guest tonight, Philip Plait, the Bad Astronomer, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, the Monday Night Show, we're going to talk about shadow people, so get ready for that one. But when we come right back, we'll finish up now with final phone calls with our special guest, astronomer Philip Plait, the Bad Astronomer, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I always wanted to use this phrase, Philip, so I might as well. What's on your plate in the not-too-distant future?
Oops, sorry.
There you are.
I was
Where
on mute
you?
There for a second. I'm planning on doing a little more writing. I've been writing on my blog actually every day or two, once or twice a day, and that's becoming more and more fun to actually turn sort of everyday scientific experience into a fun few paragraphs, and there's always something going on from whatever is going on with the private space industry or NASA, people observing on the ground, and not necessarily astronomer. I mean, astronomy, I was showering in the afternoon a few weeks ago, which is not something I usually do. I usually shower in the morning with sunlight streaming in, and I was getting rainbows all over the shower. So I actually was able to get a picture of it and blog about it. So I'm enjoying doing that, and I've got a couple of books I'm thinking about writing, and I'm writing for some magazines like Night Sky Magazine, and got the bulletin board, the Bad Astronomy Universe Today bulletin board that is going gangbusters. So all of that is going quite well, and as long as NASA funds these satellites, we'll still be able to educate people about black holes and exploding stars, too. So that's going quite well, too.
Well, you know, when you talk about them taking away funding for the school program that you were talking about, how much money were you talking about, Philip?
Well, a few years ago, there was a guy at NASA who decided that between 1% to 2% of the cost of a satellite would go towards education and public outreach. And, you know, when you're talking about a $150, $200 million satellite, that can be $2 or $3 million. And in fact, the glass satellite, I think the total amount of money we're getting over a 10 or 15 year period is $5 million. And that's a lot. I mean, really. Now, of course, when you've got a university taking its cut and the benefits and all that kind of stuff, it's and then you divide that up on a per year basis.
It's not a lot.
It's not as much as you think. I was really quite shocked. I'm thinking, wow, millions of dollars. And then you realize that later on you're counting pennies to see how many lithographs you're going to print and all that kind of stuff. It happens all the time.
We earlier talked about dark matter, trying to figure out just what the heck this may be. First of all, how did scientists, astronomers, physicists find it?
There are actually two ways, and they were relatively independent. One was that they were studying clusters of galaxies. Again, these sort of cities of galaxies where there are thousands of them orbiting each other due to their own gravity. And what they discovered was that when you try to guess at how much mass is in that cluster by how much light it's giving off. So you assume that you can count up all the light the galaxy is giving off. You can assume it's all made of stars, and that gives you a mass. They found that the mass wasn't nearly enough to hold the cluster together. And since they can figure the cluster is pretty old, billions of years old, there must be some sort of matter that you can't see whose gravity is helping hold the cluster together. And that's where dark matter came out. Then it came up when they were looking at galaxies rotating. Galaxies like the Milky Way are, like I said, giant pinwheels, and they spin, they rotate. And it turns out you can measure the mass of the galaxy that way. And again, you find out that it appears that 90% of the mass of the galaxy is dark. And then it starts popping up in all sorts of other more difficult to understand concepts. And that's, you know, that's why most astronomers feel that dark matter is real, because there's so many independent observations that support it.
Is it still theoretical?
I wouldn't say it's theoretical. I would say it's definitely there. 90% of the mass of the universe is dark, and we don't know what it is. And again, you know, there have been hundreds of candidate objects that could be from Earth-like planets that have been ejected from their stars to weird particles that have really funny names like axions and photinos and all this weird stuff. And at the moment, nobody's quite sure what it is. There are a lot of things that have been ruled out, but nothing has definitively been said to be at the heart of this. It's an ongoing mystery.
And what about wormholes? What do you think they lead to?
Wormholes. This is the idea that if you fall into a black hole, this object whose gravity is so intense that not even light can escape, they twist space so seriously that it might lead in a tunnel to another point in space, like the way a worm can eat its way through an apple. That's where the word wormhole comes from. In fact, that planetarium show I mentioned about black holes that's playing at the Denver Museum talks quite a bit about wormholes. It looks like that all the physics that we understand shows that they cannot really happen, that when you fall into a black hole, matter and space and energy get so tangled up and it's so chaotic that they can't possibly exist. But this is a young field, and who knows what we'll understand 50 years from now. Don't know.
Let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Jeff calling from North Carolina.
Hi, Jeff. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. Hi, Phil.
Howdy.
I just want to make a comment, and then I'll have a question for Phil.
Sure.
My comment is I'm a big fan of the International Space Station, and I heard you guys both claiming that there's no good research coming out of that.
Uh-oh.
And I'm a space systems engineer. I went to a conference in November on ISS utilization. And even though many of the laboratories haven't even been launched yet, they are doing some good solid science. It's mainly in life sciences and material sciences. Protein crystal growth. They're studying proteins to help develop new drugs that are larger, more pure, with less defects. There's something called a bioreactor where they're doing human tissue growth, where they're growing 3D structures real human tissues like heart muscles and kidney muscles. They can't be grown on the ground because gravity interacts with them. They're developing zeolite crystals that are larger, more pure crystals that are used to store hydrogen, for example, and are used in fuel cells. That's going to become necessary in the next few decades. And they're growing glass fibers that are longer and more pure in space than they can grow on the ground, and that's important for optical properties. So that's just some of the things that are being done in the space station. Go to spaceresearch.nasa.gov to look at all these things that are being done. You could have a program on that yourself, George. But my question for Phil is, what can be done on the moon in the area of products that we can see in the next, say, 10 years or 20 years that would justify the enormous cost of a moon base?
Well, in 10 years, probably nothing. It's hard to say exactly how long it's going to take before a moon base would become, quote-unquote, profitable. You know, that may take 100 years. But as one science fiction author is fond of saying, you know, of what use is a baby? And so, you know, it takes an enormous amount of investment to do this. And it seems logical, given what we've seen about the moon. And one of the things, certainly, is that NASA is trying to map it better to understand what resources are there. But it doesn't seem like it's that much of a stretch that by building a base on the moon, the scientific advances aside, because I know astronomy from the moon would be awesome.
Right. Astronomy, I think, is the one big objective that's justifiable.
Right. But building a spaceport there, the moon's gravity, of course, is much less. And so if you can build rockets there, it's much cheaper to get to the rest of the solar system from the moon than it is from the Earth. The question is, can that be done? I don't know. Some of these other people are talking about mining this isotope of helium called helium-3, which is useful for creating fusion. And I think that's kind of funny because I don't think you can mine that much helium-3 from the moon to do this. I'm not an expert in this.
Plus, we don't have any fusion reactors yet.
We don't have any fusion reactions. So that seems like that's kind of pie in the sky at the moment.
Right.
You know, 10 years from now, I don't know. There are enough things. There are enough materials in the lunar regolith, this dust on the surface, to be able to create things like solar panels. And the moon is deficient in metals, but it does have them. And so you could build on the moon. And once we have an established colony there, it might be easier. I would think that it would certainly be more likely that we would get better science, better engineering, better corporate products that we could build on the moon than we could from the space station. And what you said about the space station is very interesting. I'd heard some of these before, but I've also heard a lot of material scientists saying that it's not worth the expense of building it in the space station. But like I said, you know, 10, 15 years from now, we may be looking back at this time and saying, why did we ever doubt it? I don't know. But I will look at that website you recommend. As a good scientist, if somebody brings me better evidence, you know, I'm willing to change my mind, so I'll take a look.
Spaceresearch.nasa.gov. They have a lot of good information.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Phil.
All right, thanks, Jeff. Good to have you on the program. Next up, let's go east of the Rockies. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, this is John. I'm a trucker.
Good morning, John. Go ahead.
I'm in Manassas, Virginia. I wanted to tell you personally that there are millions of us out here that listen to you every night, George. You're doing
well,
great
thank
job.
You. I appreciate it.
Your personal questions that I want to pass on to you, if you really want to know, then read the Oblation of Solomon when he gave the oblation to the temple.
Okay.
That's for you personally. As far as asking Philip a question, there's a theory, or whether it's true or not, I don't know, but the whole universe is supposed to be moving at 157,000 miles an hour in one direction to what is called a great attractor. Can you give any information on that, or do you know anything about that?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I'm going to say I grew up near Manassas, Virginia, and as a matter of fact, they have a very good astronomy club out there, the Northern Virginia Astronomy Club, NOVAC, and that's a great area. The galaxy, our galaxy, the Milky Way, of 100 billion stars, appears to be moving through space at a high velocity. I don't know if it's 150,000 miles per hour or what it is. I just don't know what the number is. But it's moving in one direction, and it was inferred from that there is a giant mass out there, and that parts of this have been observed. The problem is, as I recall, our view of it is blocked by our galaxy itself, or it's blocked by something. And so it's like trying to look over a brick wall. You can only see a little bit of it peeking over the top. But it's known to be there, and it's probably a supercluster, not just a cluster of galaxies, but a cluster of clusters of galaxies. So you're talking about, you know, potentially trillions of, or hundreds of trillions of stars, maybe quadrillions of stars, and their combined mass is so mighty that it's pulling our galaxy toward it. And so, in a sense, we're orbiting it, although it would probably take, you know, hundreds of billions of years to go around it once, maybe even more. But that's what that is. And it was discovered many years ago, and it just goes to show you that there's a lot more going on out there than you might guess at first glance.
Well, you know that the scriptures say in the end, God said when it's all over and done with, the whole place is going to be rolled up like a scroll, and the old heavens and the old earth will be put away.
Start all over again.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jeff.
That's the deal. All right, thank you, George. I appreciate it.
Okay, appreciate it, too. One night, Philip, I'm going to do a CB question night. I'm going to have one trucker call in with his cell phone, hold the cell phone by his CD speaker, and have truckers call in via the CB. Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be funny. I mean, most of the time I listen to the show is when I'm driving home late at night from the airport after giving a talk someplace or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I imagine there must be a lot of listeners on the road right now.
Hey, how much snow did you get out in your neck of the woods this year?
I'm sorry, say again?
How much snow did you get out there?
It did snow not too far from here, but it extremely rarely for it to snow here in Sonoma County. It actually snowed the first winter I moved out here, and it was funny because it was just a dusting, but it's been raining. We're just getting tons of it.
More than last year?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're at a surplus now, and it's not even the end of the season.
And last year was a rainy year.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast around the year. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good, sir.
All right, I got a question for Philip. Every morning I see either a star or a planet coming up off the horizon from the southeast. I'd like to know what it is.
Well, if you give me about 15 seconds here, I think I've got some software. Oh, my gosh. You know, oh, here it is. It might take a minute to load up. One thing you can do is online, there's a great website called Heavens Above. It's heavens-above.com. And if you go there, you can put in your latitude and longitude, and it will tell you what's up in the sky at a given time. And I'm actually, while we're sitting here, while I'm telling you this, I am actually putting, I've got some software I've got loaded up, and I can actually do this and go to the east. There's the sun, and there is Mercury and Uranus and a star. I'm trying to see if Venus is up in the morning, but I don't see it. So I'm not sure what that is. It might be Mercury. What time in the morning is it?
It's about an hour or so before dawn. It's very, very bright.
I would think it would be Venus, but I don't see Venus on this map. So I don't know where Venus is.
I think it's Jupiter now, if he's doing it now.
Oh, is it in the east or the west?
East.
Yeah, Jupiter would be in the west at that time. Oh, wait a minute. I found Venus. There it is. Yeah, that's it. Definitely.
Venus.
I wasn't looking far enough away from the sun. Yeah, Venus is up pretty far from the sun, and it's extremely bright. It's going to be the brightest object in the sky except for the moon.
Yeah, it's amazing to see every morning.
Yeah, I just love this, that I can, you know, somebody can ask me a question, I can fire up the software, and within a few seconds answer the question. It's great. I wish I'd had this 15 years ago.
Right on. Thanks a lot.
Sure, thank you.
Have a good one.
Thanks. Appreciate you being on the program. Time for one more. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Good morning, George and Bad Phil.
Howdy.
Go ahead.
Good morning. I was wondering about, I had once seen briefly I think they call them photons, which is the light from a laser. Is that correct?
Well, any kind of light is made up of photons, like a particle of light.
Right, and I once saw one jump from one on like a very, like at MIT on Nova or something, where they had it jump from one beaker to another, not crossing the space. That's just one statement I wanted to make. You could correct me if I'm wrong, but they had it go from one beaker to another without crossing in between, and they said that's the best that they could do. And the question I had briefly was, why have we not been able to keep the photons tight enough, long enough to weaponize lasers? And I'll listen to your answer off the radio. Thank you.
Okay.
I remember vaguely them talking about being able to teleport a single photon from one place to another without it having to go through the space in between. I believe this has to do with something called quantum entanglement, where you create two particles at the same time, and when you create them, one has to have one attribute, and the other one has to have another. Like one is plus and one is minus, just as an example. That's not really what it is. And so what you do is if you can measure one, you know what the other one is, even though it's really far away. And it's very complicated, and I don't fully understand it as someone who hasn't studied quantum mechanics at that level. So I'm not sure how that all works. But I do know that it's very hard to do at anything other than a single event level. And as far as weaponizing lasers, that's different. I mean, there are definitely lasers that can be used as weapons. You can buy lasers on the web that can actually burn hot enough to burn paper. I've seen them advertised. It's kind of scary, actually. But that's a different story. One assumes that the military has weapons like this, but they've never had to use them. At least I hope they've never.
The website, of course, badastronomy.com. How often do you update it, Philip?
The blog is updated actually two or sometimes even three times a day. The main site, not as often, but there is a page there linked at the top of my site that has links to some of the stuff we talked to and some of the stuff we didn't get a chance to talk to.
Next time, Philip. Thanks, my friend.
Thank you, George.
Philip Plate, the Bad Astronomer. For Karis Coburn, Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition as we get the week going for you. Until then, be safe, everyone.